Write that down for me, Saito.
Write that down.
Write that.
With Fumi Saito and Justin Nipper.
Write that down.
Hi, patrons. Welcome back. It's good to have you back. Thank you for listening, as always. I'm Justin Nipper from Fight Game Media and WrestlingObserver.com, and I'm here, as always, with author, historian, broadcast journalist, professor, among many other things, Mr. Fumi Saito. Welcome.
Hello from Tokyo. How are you?
We're ready. We're definitely ready to go. So today is, I think we can finish.
I hope so, yeah.
Kijimuto.
We were going to do this Kijimuto episode, just one or two, you know, or maybe like part one and part two, but now it's what, part four?
Part four.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, Star Wars or Lord of the Rings trilogy or something.
Yeah, because Muto's legacy is that big, you know? So.
Yeah, and you know, the past couple episodes, I'm learning a lot too, like on the fly when we're talking about this. But it also,
and
last week I got a lot of good feedback. I was telling you about earlier about part three, which is definitely a different flavor or different kind of episode compared to the first two episodes we did about Kijimuto, because we really focused on the Dark Ages. That they're sort of not hard to understand, but we haven't really been able to talk about it in depth because it's still kind of fresh. The wounds are still fresh.
Yeah. I'm trying to get over it too myself.
Right. But okay, so around this time, but before we get to the main chunk of the fourth part, there was one little part we glossed over.
Okay. In
late 90s, New Japan, Kijimuto was just about to go to WCW, but before that he had a big gimmick match with one and only Atsushi Onita, who's been in the news lately as the Great Nita, in a exploding barbed wire death match. At Jingu Stadium.
Right. Great Muta against Great Nita.
Great Nita. So how did that come about? Where did that come from?
Oh, I think it was also a beginning of Dark Age of Japanese wrestling, that they would do anything to have audience.
Mm.
You know, normally in New Japan's heyday in 90s, you know, they would ignore Great Nita as a knockoff of Great Muta, obviously.
It couldn't be taken
seriously. They took that and made it in. Yeah, because Great Muta and Great Nita. The Great Muta does, you know, have real history in America, and also two different identities, you know, in the 90s, that he works as Keiji Muto one night and come out as Great Muto another night, and people understood that. And Great Nita, on the other hand, was strictly Atsushi Onita's, you know, almost like a personal, you know, like idea that he wanted to do this gimmick and he would do it, you know, and knock off or not, you know. And but New Japan in heyday would pretty much ignore the whole issue of it, but instead they took it kind of like when Ricky Choshu decided to bring Onita in and does a barbed wire match. If you remember Ricky Choshu against Atsushi Onita's barbed wire, you know, explosive match, that Ricky Choshu didn't even sell it. Remember,
he didn't give Onita anything. It was pretty almost funny. If you want to, I think it's on New Japan World, but if anybody wants to watch that, it's very different from Kenny Omega and John Moxley's death match from a few weeks ago. It was pretty much just Ricky Choshu, like you said, not selling and giving Onita.
And he didn't even sell explosive. He didn't even sell barbed wire. You know, he just stood there. It was funny, huh? But it's like in old-fashioned wrestling philosophy, it's like that like expose, you know, and not good for business. But then again, it was New Japan philosophy. What we do is pretty real, and what Onita's been doing is like it's fantasy, you know, kind of thing. But what came out, people have to understand, you know, the match took place and Ricky Choshu and Onita were, you know, they were in the ring together. The match happened, and what Ricky Choshu did, what Onita did, he was still Onita. You know?
Who made the decision to bring Onita in at around that time?
I think it was Mr. Nagashima, who was part of the production and producer, you know, executive producer team in New Japan at the time. Yeah.
At that time, did New Japan have, was it just run through the main booker and the wrestling team, or did TV Asahi have input?
No, TV Asahi never have much to it, because it was New Japan is still, to this day, pretty old-fashioned in that they don't tell TV Asahi people pretty much anything at all. That they sports, you know, that the professional sport production team from, in the broadcasting team and the camera crew and the technician and all the, you know, truck, you know, they all come in and tape the New Japan shows. But actually New Japan, you know, creatives don't tell them much. Just go ahead and tape everything professionally.
Pretty old school.
Yeah, to this day, yes. But then again, TV Asahi people have, they think they know too. There's a tension between, it's like they'll never flat out say who's going to go over today, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they ask that today either.
I haven't heard anything, no.
Yeah. So it's like they come, TV Asahi people come in and tape everything, and they, you know, edit professionally, and they make their own, you know, the masterpiece of footage, you know? And that's what New Japan wants.
And so what might not have been a masterpiece, but was definitely a match, was the Onita and Muto blow-off at Jingu Stadium in 99. And how was that received?
It was also dark age, you know. If in a different time, in a different, you know, era, it could have been bigger news, you know. But people weren't paying all that much attention to Great Muta against Great Nita, all that much. Not as much as you think today, you know?
It definitely felt like both Onita and Muto and even Riki Choshu, their prime had finished.
At the time, it looked that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, felt that way. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Because it felt like they didn't have any...
But time was bad though, you know, really. Mm. It was the same time period where Pride, the K1, the whole MMA thing was getting so big that what wrestling did, it almost didn't make any difference. You know, that people realized, you know, if it was all, you know, well, I don't want to use the word real, but if it was a real fight, it would look like MMA.
There was definitely a kind of obsession almost with realistic looking fights and MMA style, because MMA it was developing, it was sort of established but not completely yet, and
in Japan there was a more crossover, that the people like, you know, Yuji Nagata or we talked about that last week, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or Kendo Kashin, the legitimate, you know, background professional wrestler, you know, was sent to Pride and K1, and they ended up losing it, right?
Mm.
Losing the match. So it's like they really, really damaged the credit of professional wrestling at the time.
And this, arguably, this Muto and Onita match was maybe a prototype, or not prototype, but just the early stages of this period, seemed like.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, what would Great Muta against Great Nita present? Represent, like, well, that's like a character against character. Oh, that's professional wrestling, and they use, you know, weapons, and then they blow mist, and they do the all kinds of crazy gimmicks that the real fight wouldn't contain. How's that?
Was there any pressure to come off or present the wrestling more like WWE at that time because of how popular WWE?
Oh, they were struggling, so they were doing. Or they experiment anything to get the audience, live audience, or the TV ratings back, you know, any topic. Yes.
There's a kind of desperation because between Pride and K1.
It looks that way. Yeah, it looks that way. Because general audience was moving towards more and more towards MMA, Pride, the K1, the real fight, the kickboxing, heavyweight kickboxing and all that. You know, that the New Year's Eve every year, remember?
Big shows.
They have this. Oh, God.
K1,
yeah.
Pride.
Inoki Bombaye. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All night long.
Big ratings, mm-hmm. too. Massive.
Yeah, I think so.
It was trendy. It was almost, I think, a lot of people that never liked wrestling or never liked fighting, they...
Or the combat sports in general.
Yeah, it was kind of like a social trend in the time, too.
with Network Channel doing the, you know, Las Vegas production. Mm-hmm. You know?
I actually have, I have two friends who live near me, and it's an American guy who lived in Japan and he had a Japanese wife, but they met, their first date was at a Pride show in like 99 or 2000.
Yeah.
Because the, it kind of had that appeal.
The trendy.
Yeah. Cause it was very flashy. It was like you said, like a Vegas show, like boxing or it was even more over the top.
Yeah, it was like that.
I mean,
yeah, that's how people like Bob Sapp got huge overnight.
Exactly. And I wanted to bring him up because in around 2004, Muto even teamed with Bob Sapp. That's how big Bob Sapp was.
Professional wrestling match. If you think about that, in traditional wrestling, you know, community or professional wrestling circle, you would not put somebody like Bob Sapp into your main event spot right away. Mm-mm. That would hurt the business. Credibility.
Big gamble.
I mean, if there was a credibility to start with, but the, you know, they were willing to produce somebody like Bob Sapp as a huge superstar, like a almost overnight sensation. And he was big star for, of, say, 5-year period. Yeah.
Actually,
or even WWE Vince McMahon himself wanted Bob Sapp at one point.
Yeah. I think at one point he was scheduled to have a fight with Mike Tyson for K1. That was on the table.
Yeah, something like that. Right, right.
But it's funny because I got a picture today. There's an ad someone sent me that's in Tokyo, and it's with Bob Sapp, actually. He's promoting something, a Made in Japan CBD oil. I can send you the picture later and when we upload it on Patreon.
What's a CBD oil?
It's a TH, like a CBD. Well, I don't know the acronym for, but CBD oil is that... Wow, I didn't know I'd have to explain CBD on the show. It's just okay. A chemical compound that's found in marijuana. And if you extract it and use the oil, it can be used as like oil.
Aesthetic?
Yeah, it could be for joint pain. It could be for, you know, people who have anxiety or issues with seizures or epilepsy. But I don't know exactly what this is.
But it's not exactly medicine.
Not exactly medicine. It's more maybe recreational. I don't know. I'll send you the ad later, but it said
okay.
It's him and it says plus weed. And there's a CBD. Okay, I'll send this later.
All right.
So that's what he's
something
up
like
to.
That. But it tells you that he's still marketable, right?
I mean, he's a phenomenon. And so I don't completely understand his story, which will someday have to come back
Bob
to.
Bob Sapp was not just in those MMA and professional wrestling ring, but he was on game show. He was in quiz show. He was in Japanese movie. He made a music video. And it was like a sensational superstar for about 5-year period.
Nonstop.
Yeah, you know how Japanese media will make somebody star overnight and make you big, you know, I mean, like too fast almost.
Mm.
But that's an epitome of, you know, he is, I mean, not personally, but the Bob Sapp phenomena is like epitome of Japanese dark age of professional wrestling. Yeah.
Because he was a part of a lot of the highlights from those periods, from those times. Either if it's in Hustle or if it's in K1 or if it's in Pride or later Raijin. I mean, he's an important factor, like you said. And
yeah, I think so.
And
I
Muto
so.
I mean, teamed with him to main event.
He was willing to, yeah.
Which says a lot about at least Bob Sapp. But do you remember how the match went?
You know, that's like escaping me, you know, really.
Maybe you tried
to... I must have watched it.
Tried to forget.
Yeah, because I watch everything and I must have watched it, you know, live. But or some of the Pride and K1 shows or the K1 produced very initial Wrestle 1 shows at Tokyo Dome. I was there, but I kind of forget what happened, you know.
Mm.
Nothing, you know, I mean, like as far as wrestling match goes, you know, it really was, it wasn't anything, you know.
It's more about the experience. It seemed like.
Yeah, or the what happened in this Hustle period, you know. Great Muta and the Nobuhiko Takada in this Hitler costume. Was just something you gotta forget, you know.
Well, there were better things that Muto was involved with in the year, too. I think 2004, 2005 was also the first time he was in the ring.
You know, the reason Muto was always involved in this, it was not Muto who needed them. It was them who wanted to use Muto.
Because of how big of a star he was?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he was president of All Japan by now. 2004, 2005.
And also one of the most, you know, if not the most famous wrestler in Japan. If not, it's Inoki, you know, Inoki's retired and Baba's dead, and who's really, really famous. Keiji Muto is famous wrestler. Mm. I mean, ask anybody from, on the street corner or regular TV viewer, who do you know, professional wrestler? Keiji Muto is a famous one, really.
And they'll say him now, these days, before Riki Dozan or somebody like that, for sure.
Yeah, and then also Riki Dozan is in black and white television era where every single household watched television religiously.
Mm-hmm. Different family structure.
Yeah, and then the center of the living room was television then, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that meant something really special to those generations.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I think we're so far away from
it. Yeah, so it's a cultural icon. Cultural icon and first television hero. But the things are more complicated. We had more media outlet, in the 80s and 90s, even before internet. Then the internet, time era starts. And we have to sort through this, outside wrestling, this, technology and what, the things that changed our everyday life.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what, I guess we can say that's why part of this was a dark age, because we had the quality of what was going on in Japan. Plus, there was no YouTube yet. There was streaming was not readily
not
available.
Quite, yeah. Internet was there, but not moving image.
It wasn't convenient to you couldn't just watch. I can watch New Japan World live. I can see these guys live like anytime now.
Yes. And yeah.
That's unthinkable to me 20 years ago. It's just, it was a different time.
Right.
It was just like, if it's not good.
But if you were 20 years old, 20 years old now, or 25, or even 30 at that they've been watching media like this, past 15 years. Some of these wrestling fans were born in 2000, 2002. And they had their cell phone and internet as a kid, a little kid. Mm. So what they know and what we know is a two different world, right?
They only know the bald Muto.
Right, yeah. Right.
So, Ed, so around this time, too, he didn't officially go back to New Japan, but he did win the IWGP heavyweight title around 2008.
Technically, during year 2000, he was still under contract with New Japan, and New Japan was sending Muto to dying day of All Japan. On All Japan, the Misawa's whole group, which became Pro Wrestling North, the 20 guys with referee and ring crew, the production, the office worker, all left. But then Mrs. Baba, did not give up and wanted to continue. And, with All Japan, they needed talent. And they re-signed Tenryu. And Kawada was still there. They needed somebody like Keiji Muto. And also, you and I talked about that last week, that the executive, namely Mr. Nagashima, but the executive of New Japan had planned of buying All Japan from Mrs. Baba at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was their choice, choosing to send Muto and have him work for a whole year. They can't help but have to sell it, right?
Mm.
But New Japan didn't buy it. Muto himself bought it,
And I think because we were talking about it so much earlier, about the popularity of MMA, Pride, and K1, when Keiji Muto left and associated with All Japan, it really truly was the opposite stylistically of what was going on. So it was a choice made by Mrs. Baba and Keiji Muto to go in orthodox or traditional,
traditional
pro wrestling style.
Yes,
MMA.
And that's no mistake about it. That's exactly the only thing what Muto does. Muto is, how popular Muto is. He would not go into MMA matches. No.
He never compromised his style or what he was bringing.
Yeah, maybe he would have been good. Athletic-wise, and he would have been really good MMA fighter, maybe, but then it never happened. And also, for Muto's philosophy, what's the point?
We talked about it before, but in 1995, he fought against that style with pro wrestling. He beat Takada with Dragon Screw.
Traditional figure four leg lock.
It was so, I mean, I've never heard people talk about a spot or a move like that so much that moved them and defined who Muto is, even today. I mean, it was a representation of, hey, I'm not going that way. I'm going to do this. I'm staying in this style. I'm doing my style, and I can beat you with it. And that,
yeah, you would think if you know, at the time in the period of 1994 to 1995, if you had a single match against Nobuhiko Takada, you would be taking that kicks and submissions, right? Mm-hmm. You would think you'd be having UWF style wrestling match, and that's their ball game, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But Muto got in the ring with Nobuhiko Takada and did Muto's style wrestling and brought Takada into his style, which was, oh God, it's like a defying moment, yes.
And really, I think, reassuring or hopeful moment for fans of that
style.
Oh,
very much so. Oh, very much so. But it did not help professional wrestling genre as a whole. It was individually Muto, yeah, how great he was. But he did not necessarily help the entire wrestling community either.
And things changed,
yeah,
because
the whole atmosphere, you know, the whole genre, that the whole wrestling community or the whole combat sport was still moving towards MMA, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're going to fast forward back to like mid-2000s. Yes. So we were talking about Nakamura and the IWGP.
Yeah.
He got back involved, Muto got back involved with New Japan and beat a young Shinsuke Nakamura for the IWGP heavyweight title. And it was around 2008.
And young Tanahashi was already there, mm-hmm. very young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, young lion.
I think that's who he lost it to the next year is Tanahashi. He had a match with Tanahashi. Mm-hmm. They had matches in All Japan and in New Japan. And I think this was around the time where they sent Tanahashi to All Japan.
To All Japan
Carnival,
for the Champion Carnival. Yeah.
Where, if anybody's interested, this is the very rare time we saw Tanahashi as heel.
And short hair.
Shorter hair. And it seemed like he really enjoyed himself as a heel.
Yeah, because, you know, if you're younger, you know, like a second, third year pro or as a professional wrestler, you would think about, you know, second, third year rookie, you know, having a single match against Ric Flair or Hulk Hogan in big stage all of a sudden, you know, it was like that.
I think that was part of the beginning of the high points of his career started around this time. And I think.
Yeah, well, the dark period or not, I believe, you know, Nakamura and Tanahashi would be big star one way or another, but he really, you know, was, he started in a not so, you know, like a fortunate time, you know what I mean?
Mm.
But he was so talented that he became a next generation star, yes.
I think of many of the modern wrestlers today, I think Tanahashi is a great comparison to Keiji Muto if there's a modern
version. Yeah, yeah, very, yes. Style is not necessarily similar, but the way he present himself,
mm-hmm.
he carry himself as a star, and yeah.
No MMA, like that, still pro wrestling, New Japan style.
Yeah.
Big, pretty tall, more or less.
Yeah, actually not as tall as Muto, but
Muto is quite tall. Would,
yeah. But the Tanahashi or Shinsuke Nakamura, for that matter, he would not do like MMA-ish looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's a progressor. You know, you wouldn't do the karate kick. You would do the drop kick instead. You know, Nakamura does the kick, but that's more presented as a king of strong style.
Martial artist.
Still in like a pro wrestling category though, you know?
But it's kind of like the ongoing story or theme between what's style versus style. That I think we see still lightly. It's not outwardly in our faces, but I think that's always an underlying theme in a lot of big matches.
Yeah, because professional wrestling never gave up the idea of make-believe. You know, the merit and the whole thing of professional wrestling is, you know, you suspend your disbelief while watching it, right?
Mm.
And like make-believe. I mean, basically still. I mean, knowing it's all work, knowing it's sports entertainment. But when you are actually sitting in the seat and watching it, you don't think about that. When you see a good match, you enjoy a good wrestling match, you know?
And it seemed like...
Does that make sense?
Oh, I think so. And I think it's because Muto always seemed like, at the end of the day, he wanted to make sure that the crowd was entertained. and not just a sport, but he wanted to give a show. And I think when you approach the job like that, he's constantly in a giving kind
and,
of
and Muto has this unique talent that he would put together his own match that goes beyond your imagination. You know, like wrestling fans have veterans, right? 10-year veteran watching it, 20-year veteran of watching, you know, being wrestling fan, 30-year veteran of being wrestling fan. They have all the knowledge. But Muto is one of the very few wrestlers who can still go beyond their imagination. For instance, the figure four leg lock was too.
In a simple way too, in a kind of a clever or logical way.
Yeah, think about his new finish that, you know, he brought back, you know, 2000 on, Shining Wizard, running into a guy with just knee, simple, right?
Mm.
But when he does it with his pose and the whole introduction, and he's going into Shining Wizard pose and give it and execution, it just, that's his, you know, people believe it's, he just beat the guy.
He completely you know? Branded it, that whole
I think so. Part. I think so. And what's so good about Muto is, though, that the wrestling, actual wrestlers, a lot of wrestlers are fan of Muto. That you, after you see, you know, great Muto, I mean, Keiji Muto's match, next day, the other guys would start using Shining Wizard tomorrow.
He's very copied. He's one of the most copied wrestlers,
so.
I think. And like you said last week, even...
He's the original.
Even The Rock borrowed from Muto.
Yeah, the driving elbow thing, and made it into people's elbow.
Yeah.
It was new to a lot of people, huh?
I think so. I never heard that. But when I thought about it for a second, it made complete sense. It's just...
Yeah, it really did come... You know, I'll say that one more time, that it really did come from The Rock. The Rock and Funaki, the show Funaki, was talking backstage at the SmackDown one night. You know, hey, and Rock is a friendly guy, right? And he's like, do you think, you know, I could tour Japan? He's like, of course. You could tour any company, New Japan, Old Japan, and be top gaijin, right? But... Rock, Dwayne Johnson came, you know, he was an active during the period that there was no connection between, no partnership between WWE and Japanese wrestling. And, you know, Rock himself wondered that what would it be, you know, would it be like to tour, you know, Japan as a wrestler and just work against Japanese wrestler, you know, every night for 1 month period with people who doesn't share the language. And you have to wrestle. And do you think I could wrestle in Japan? It's like, of course you could wrestle in Japan, but he wondered, you know?
Did his father, Rocky Johnson, ever wrestle in Japan?
Yeah, Old Japan Wrestling and New Japan Wrestling too, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and Peter Maivia too.
Peter Maivia with Japan Wrestling?
JWA and the International IWE and later on New Japan, yeah.
So his family had quite a legacy in Japan already.
Well, if you look into history book, there's a championship tournament called Madison Square Garden Series.
Mm-hmm.
It's a New Japan's, you know, spring tournament before IWGP tournament. There was a single match between Peter Maivia against Riki Choshu.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
What the generations that spans.
In the mid-70s.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, like, today's wrestler, you know, like Roman Reigns, he really never toured Japan, right? But their uncles, you know, father Shika and uncle Afa, the original Wild Samoans, they came to Japan so many times and, you know, they worked in Japan. And they heard about it. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that the Samoans, original Samoans worked for International IWE. They worked, had a tour with Old Japan. And a little bit later on, they had tours with New Japan. Afa and Shika, the Wild Samoans. So they all grew up, you know, like witnessing that their fathers, their uncles, they all went to Japan and worked. And then it's like they would wonder, you know, that what would be like that if I worked, you know, went to tour, not WWE tour, but as a professional wrestler, you go to Japan and work Japanese company for a period of time. Can I work it? You know, can I work there? And this generation of American wrestlers ended up watching a lot of Japanese videos, like something real far away.
More and more these days, too.
Yeah, and then also like people like not Muto, but on the other side, all Japan's 90s era, you know, Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada matches. They look great matches, right, on video, but they are the people that you'll probably never get to work with.
Right. Actually, speaking of Misawa, around this time, 2009, that's when Misawa passed away in the ring. And I think that was another big point in the dark ages of
this
time. Oh,
God. Yeah. Yeah. And somebody like that, and I think, you know, well, not a lot, but some people did die, you know, some wrestlers, you know, did die in ring. But I believe Misawa was the biggest star who, you know, had an accident in ring.
Yeah. I think so. Unless it's you want to talk Owen Hart, but that was a different situation.
There was a difference. Mm. Yeah, like it was an entrance, you know.
So
not a wrestling
in a wrestling,
wrestling
match.
Match.
Oh, didn't Silver King just pass away a couple of years ago in the ring in England?
Yeah, right. But
higher
like,
profile is what you mean.
Yes,
I see.
Yeah, I'm not saying Silver King or
I know what you mean.
Pero Aguayo Jr. or somebody like that. You know. Or Gary Albright, for that matter. Yes, he did die in the ring. But Misawa was
a
leader.
Big star.
Big star.
Important part of the
pro wrestling history.
Puzzle. Yeah, I mean.
Maybe.
Would you say that Keiji Muto was Misawa's kind of contemporary? They were kind of like.
Of course.
It was like captains
modern
of both teams.
Yeah, and the ace quarterback in the dressing room, like a leader.
Okay, so they're like the kind of dream rivals.
And just like Inoki and Baba, Misawa and Muto never had single match.
They did have a tag match, though, did they?
At the Tokyo Dome, yeah.
Was there?
So every time they're in the ring together, working against each other, it was huge. But that single match never happened.
Was that ever in the plans?
I kind of don't think so. How are you going to get out of it?
Yeah.
You know?
And
But the early 90s, when I spoke with Keiji Muto in person, he had no trouble putting him over.
Hmm.
I mean, that much respect Muto had for Misawa.
Wow.
But then again, probably 10 years later, it's like a political situation. It's different. They couldn't do it, you know?
And Misawa's body had changed a lot by then, too.
Both guys. Mm. It's the same way that the reason Misawa has the long tights, the reason Muto has the long tights is that both guys have all taped up knees. Yeah. You cannot wear single short trunks. Your knees, both legs are all taped up. You know, you can't go out there like that.
So we're going to fast forward a little bit because
in
2013...
Yes. Yeah.
This was pretty much the last point for Muto.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say going to 2013 was when Keiji Muto ended up deciding to leave All Japan after almost 10 years or so of being the...
Right. Because believe it or not, he really, you know, had to spend his own money to maintain that version of All Japan. And new sponsor, money guy came in and Muto had a falling out, disagreement, all those things. And he said, F it. And he just wanted to just leave. But just like the other times that Muto could not leave all by himself, that when Muto decided to leave All Japan again, that you would have 10 other wrestlers who wants to do so with him.
And he left along with Satoshi Kojima once again.
Yeah, and Kazuhayashi or the then current All Japan roster, yes.
Mm-hmm. And from there, that's where we got this next part of Wrestle 1, Keiji Muto's Wrestle 1.
Second version of Wrestle 1, yes. W1, yeah.
Not with the new K1 money. Version.
Not K1 version of the, you know, Wrestle 1 in the millennium time period, but this time, they could have named differently, but the Muto said, well, Wrestle 1, you know, W1, you know.
Right. Yeah. And this became more of like just like his promotion, his connections.
If there was any shortcoming at all about Keiji Muto's legacy, that the thing is, though, he should have never, you know, run the wrestling office. He is like your Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels type, that he is a superstar in the ring. he should have never run a company. You know what I'm saying?
He
could be the highest paid talent, and that's what he should be. But during this 10-year All Japan, Muto version of All Japan company, he really spent up his own cash to maintain the company for everybody, you know? Yeah.
And it was in a time where it wasn't the best time in...
time period for wrestling.
To invest in a wrestling company, yeah.
And Muto's version of All Japan did not have network television's budget.
Right.
See, Baba was new, you know, Baba was Nippon TV, Channel 4's huge budget. Antonio Inoki into Riki Choshu era, the TV Asahi's weekly budget. They had production money. They had enough budget to run the company annually. But Muto did not really have TV money to do the All Japan. But he went ahead and did it, you know.
Is that why he wanted to team up with TNA for a short time?
Yeah. And also he made, you know, while he was with All Japan, he made appearance with people like Hustle, you know?
Yeah. The dreaded Hustle.
Yeah. He, remember, always great Muta was part of Hustle's big show. But it was nothing to do with his All Japan operation. He took the booking, you know, individually.
So at this point, he was kind of, Keiji Muto was not the 90s Keiji Muto. That was the competitor Keiji Muto. We weren't seeing that as much as the star, the superstar making only superstar appearances generally.
Yeah.
And Wrestle One lasted only a couple of years from around 2013, and last year it folded, but Muto left the company before it folded.
Again, and also during the second version of Wrestle One, Muto never had a full-time schedule. You know, very limited appearance. And also, Kaz Hayashi was running the company instead.
Yeah, and I believe Muto had a major double knee surgery in the past couple of years.
Right, right.
So he was just out.
It's more important for us, for him, himself, that how can he maintain and be, you know, stay being an active wrestler. Now he's still active, you know, not retired, not semi-retired. He would take, you know, limited, you know, booking, and I don't think he's going to make every show with Pro Wrestling NOR this time, but he's under contract with Pro Wrestling NOR now.
You know? It's kind of like Brock Lesnar.
I don't think he's going to have full-time schedule ever.
No, we'll see him in the main events and title defenses, like a Brock Lesnar and all, character.
And in the big shows, yeah.
Just like this weekend, with Kaito Kimiya in Fukuoka, yeah.
Fukuoka. Because Muto's on the card, Fukuoka Kokusai Center becomes their big event. Yeah.
Is he beloved in Fukuoka?
Well, I believe so. And also, Pro Wrestling NOAH drew that many people in the last 10 years or so, you know, without Muto. You know, Muto makes the difference. He really does.
He's still a draw. He's still important to people.
I think so. And also, he's going to work like today's Muto, you know. He's not going to look like he's 90s, you know, Keiji Muto or 2000s Muto for that matter, but that he works very smart. He can still, you know, have longer match, like a 20-25 minute match, very storytelling match. He's not going there to have Kiyomiya style running match, 100 miles an hour match, but he will make his opponent work Muto's style.
Very much felt. Oh yeah, it felt like that very much so over the weekend. I just watched it, and
so he's more Ric Flair now than he was 10 years ago.
He's back on the semi-active situation. He's back in the semi-active roster.
Yeah, and then evidently that the more American fans are talking about Pro Wrestling NOAH, that these people didn't, you know, watch or follow or give a, you know, rat's ass about, you know, Pro Wrestling NOAH last 5-10 years. All of a sudden, they're talking about Pro Wrestling NOAH this and Pro Wrestling NOAH that. All because of Muto, right?
He's been that kind of guy. He always has been. He seems to be the most familiar Japanese wrestler to the outside.
American audience or worldwide. Yeah, worldwide audience. And also, I believe this is very special because this is going to be his final run.
Yeah, I'm assuming so. He's almost 60 and
58. Yeah, right.
And I don't know if you saw at the show before, maybe a week or so ago, but the image that was going around was that he missed his handspring elbow.
Did he? Oh, probably did. Yeah.
It was pretty bad. It was kind of worrisome.
But then after that, probably he, you know, looks back and he'll probably stop doing it.
Well, you know what? As I said, I watched the match with Kiyomiya recently, and it was actually a great match. And like you said, it felt very much like a Keiji Muto paced match, and it didn't take away from Kiyomiya looked good. I mean, Kiyomiya is very short compared to Keiji Muto. It's hard to take it seriously because Muto is a lot bigger, but they worked a smart match and they worked around that.
And then if you work wrestling holds, you know,
it's a lot of
work, work body parts, you know, and then do a few things and go back to your legs and knees and, you know, sit tight and do the wrestling, you know, that will become Muto kind of match. And also Kiyomiya, everybody knows Kiyomiya now, you know, even the non-pro wrestling, no offense, New Japan Gore, you know, that the other, you know, WWE fans in Japan, they all know Kiyomiya, you know, because of the title match. And now you'll see what I mean when you see next title defense. Muto will make Masa Kiyomiya a star.
Wow.
If not a star, like a main event, you know, guy, we'll recognize him as, that guy's a main event too.
So,
you know what I'm saying?
Masa Kiyomiya is one of the last proteges of Mr. Saito, is that right?
And Kensuke Sasaki.
And Kensuke Sasaki. And I was very surprised when this was announced because I didn't think of Kiyomiya as a guy who would have a singles match with Keiji Muto in a main event. Did you?
Oh, it's still an experiment, you know. But maybe when the night is over, he might be your next Kevin Owens. How's that?
I'm very interested. I think that was a good plug for Noah.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. And Kiyomiya is very promising because this guy grew up as a huge wrestling fan, you know.
He does. Yeah. Does he feel a little bit like a Roman Reigns the past couple of years, though? In how much Noah's wanted their audience to accept him as the main guy?
The pro wrestling Noah has, you know, a few guys that can be main event, like Kano, you know, and of course that Maru Fuji will take the veteran's role. Oh,
I see.
Too, you know, having single match against Maru Fuji, you'll become star.
Sure, sure.
That kind of thing. Yeah. And so superstar rub is very important, you know.
And it comes from Muto, and I think we've
come full circle. Wouldn't you want to have a single match, title match at the big show, you know, atmosphere, a single match main event against Muto? That's your very, you know, special day.
Yeah. I was very interested at first when he had his match with Go Shiozaki because I didn't know how far Muto could still go in the ring. I didn't know how his knees felt, and I hadn't watched him wrestle in a really serious match. I've seen him wrestle in those 6-man tag matches, but that's...
And he wouldn't do much.
Yeah, because he didn't have to. People were, you know, people were pretty wild for him anyway. I mean, that's one of the smart things about how he works.
Oh, I know that. Yeah. Oh, 6-man situation. And, you know, he'd tag in, and first thing he would do, they want a cartwheel, you know, elbow thing, and a couple more things, and he tags out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Gives and a second time he comes in, yeah, he does a short drop kick to people's knee. And tags out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, more or less, it's the same guy. It's a different version of Muto, but it's 58-year-old Muto.
I believe it's very important for Noah to have Muto as champion for a while, you know?
How did he make his way into Noah?
I guess he was asked. Yeah. He wouldn't go back to other companies. Old Japan or New Japan, you know, and a third major company is always Pro Wrestling Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pro Wrestling Noah has their own crew, a group of people. And Pro Wrestling Noah is still believable logo, I think.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of momentum going forward, the new cyber agent ownership.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
A lot of new
bigger budget
money
than other companies. Yes.
The production looks amazing.
Yes. Yeah, and also they could afford Muto's contract.
That's right, too.
Yeah. And but I don't necessarily believe Muto will work, you know, under the cyber, you know, agent company that Muto will be making appearance with DDT big shows. I kind of don't think so.
Although, I feel like, I don't know this, but I feel like...
He might, yeah.
I feel like Muto, if he wants to do something for another company. I mean, I think he's one of those Minoru Suzuki type wrestlers where it's always going to be okay if he makes a special appearance, like a Jushin Liger, where show up.
Yeah, because that makes their show be special.
And yeah. We should mention that he made an appearance, Keiji Muto made an appearance at Madison Square Garden a couple of years ago at the...
with New Japan's American show, mm-hmm. Yes.
But he kind of appeared independently just on his own for the...
And also wasn't even announced. It was not a dark match. Well, let's call it a dark match for them.
Yeah, opener.
It was a dark match opening battle royal. They didn't even tell, you know, who's in it. And then the music starts. That was Liger. The music hit. That was Great Muta. Oh my gosh, kind of thing. Oh, right?
People really, really lost their minds. They didn't.
Because it was like a bonus track. Oh my gosh, I never expected that night. You know that you eyewitness Great Muta in person. Yeah.
And you know it. If it happened in Japan, like at Tokyo Dome, it would be well accepted, and people would love it. But because it happened at such a special venue and the first time
Madison
a show
Square Garden.
At that scale, I think it was really special for the fans that were
and
there.
It worked out perfect because Muto was already in town in New York City with WrestleCon and independent appearance, and yeah, he was already in New York. Yeah, everything worked out perfect.
When do you think Keiji Muto will actually retire?
Ooh.
Maybe never.
I don't think, because that's Giant Baba's philosophy. But the professional wrestlers don't retire, really.
Mm.
You are Giant Baba 24/7. You know, mm-hmm. You are Keiji Muto 24/7, and maybe he does have. You know, he'll probably have a retirement, but maybe after a couple 3 years after retirement, he might have another special match. You know. If he can move.
He seems to always be aware of the time period, what's going on in the world. And
very smart, huh?
He's always reacting to that.
Almost like a lion, you know, like a, just a jungle, you know, like he can smell it.
Adapting,
right?
Adapting to the environment.
Yeah, he can sense it. This is a great timing to do so. And then he can sense that, huh?
I felt that way about Terry Funk, too. Terry Funk had that characteristic.
Oh, Terry Funk was huge in the 70s and the 80s, but when he started doing the more hardcore single match against Sabu, making an appearance with ECW, and there was a movie Beyond the Mat, it's just that was his another run.
He had new fans.
Ah, yeah, I think so.
So
then if you're a serious enough wrestling fan, you go back all the footage and you know start watching his old matches and kind of learn something.
He was a very different... From what we saw in ECW, is a different Terry Funk than what we saw, you know, with the tag team matches in Old Japan against Sheik and the
Funk's era. Yeah. And Terry Funk even had NWA Heavyweight Champion, you know, run too. Yeah.
He's another one we'll have to focus on in the future.
Oh, Terry Funk. Oh, I can talk about Terry Funk all night long. Yeah.
But first, we promised it a month ago, but we didn't end up getting to it. But now, since I think we're pretty much finished with the Keiji Muto profile, I think next time we're going to get together and we're going to talk about Stan Hansen.
Stan? Oh, okay.
And because
Stan Hansen, to this day, biggest American superstar in Japan.
Yeah, and no one is like him. And he's almost more of a Japanese, he's a Japanese star. He's an American wrestler, but a Japanese star.
Oh, yeah, Japanese star, yeah. And I believe, besides Terry Funk, he is the most famous American guy with cowboy hat.
I think he was like to a lot of people, he was a real-life John Wayne.
John Wayne, yeah.
He was a real cowboy.
So. And also so vicious in the ring, but when you have outside ring photos of Stan, like... Nice, likable, you know, middle-aged guy with white mustache, smiling, you know? I mean, he's a likable guy.
I think Japanese crowds really loved that dichotomy between the two, the aggressive Stan Hansen versus the one who can read the air outside of the ring.
And then plus what American audience, you know, need to, you know, be reminded is that in Japan, there is no promo, remember?
Mm-hmm. It's all based on the competition in the ring.
And what you do in the ring. You see, how many years Stan Hansen worked? 30 years in Japan. They never had one of those backstage skits. They not once had the promo, like, you know, like you grab a microphone and give a long speech or do the storyline or anything like that. He just came in and wrestled.
And I think what people need to realize before we go into this is that, okay, when people generally talk about Japanese style pro wrestling, pro wrestling, they think about fast, hard hitting, nonstop, really athletic style, really physical style of pro wrestling in general. That's right. But
that's partially, yes.
In general, generally, there's a lot more to
generally,
it.
Yes.
But
yeah,
that kind of style that we see today was really a Stan Hansen import, that nonstop, 100%. Don't stop on the small tours, go all the way on every single show. That style that kind of brought All Japan up in the late 80s and early 90s, even before that, we can attribute that to Stan Hansen.
Yeah, and then also, this is exactly what's so great about professional wrestling. There is no language band, you know, boundaries. You can watch the video, and no subtitles or no lines. It's just you watch a wrestling match and understanding. You know, have a clear understanding of what wrestling is, what pro wrestling is.
It was very.
You can just watch it, right?
Yeah, you can watch it with no
sound. You don't need the
language. He was very spontaneous, just kind of like Keiji Muto. He was always responding to what would he do in that real moment.
Yeah, and also he was so nearsighted that across the ring you actually seeing things, you know,
right? And it was sometimes a bit scary for his opponent,
I guess.
That,
yeah,
I'd never seen anybody throw a lariat like that. That was something to behold. And
oh, to Kawada or Kobashi, or yeah, and also he was a big rival of Jumbo Tsura's era.
Mm-hmm.
Jumbo Tsura against Stans. I do not know how many times they've met in the ring, you know, including tag team match, maybe hundreds. You know, if not 100,000, but yeah.
And he's one of the first big rivals of Andre the Giant. I mean, those.
Oh, yeah. When he worked at All Japan, New Japan, yes.
Yeah, those.
Yeah, picked Andre the Giant up like nothing and gave body slam.
And the crowd, you can watch the matches.
Oh, they went nuts.
It's just electric. It was like they really believed that this cowboy could take on the Giant. It was like watching a movie.
And they did this match with no promo, though.
They didn't need it. You know what I'm saying? They didn't need it. And
when you think about the WrestleMania 3, Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant, Hogan against Andre, how many promos and storyline and NBC special, Saturday Night Main Event, all these storyline and the making in 6 months, that just very different, right?
Very different approach.
Yeah.
And different results.
Yeah, Stan Hansen and Andre the Giant just went in and had the match. And people talk about it to this day.
And it holds up, of course. But we can talk about that in a lot
Yeah,
more
we'll
next
have
time.
Probably like a Stan Hansen mini series, like a two, you know, like a one or two, maybe like a three episode. But one last thing that I want to point out about Stan, because people asked me about how well he spoke Japanese, you know, in official interview, Stan Hansen always answers like, "Oh, the only thing I regret from my Japanese, you know, Japanese run as you know the whole career, I never learned, right? Learned Japanese, but it's not entirely, you know, accurate. That's what I'm saying. It's not entirely accurate. He understands Japanese language a lot more than he can speak.
It's a very Japanese answer, actually."
Yeah, is it?
Don't you think
he
so?
Never,
he said he doesn't speak, but he actually is quite good. He's being kenkyo.
Well, because he's in the Japanese dressing room for 30-year period, and he actually always understood what's going on.
Was he kind of a role model for the backstage foreigners?
The always boss, and you know that I don't know how many Americans you know came and you know went, but. Stan Hansen was always in this, you know, gaijin dressing room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, with his thick glasses, he's always reading the news, you know, English written newspapers like Japan Times or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. He's always reading newspaper. And some wrestlers walk out of dressing room and comes back 10, 15 minutes later. And Stan Hansen said, "What was that about?" Right? he has to know what's going on. But among Japanese people and Japanese language, I believe Stan Hansen understood a whole lot more than he let out. But he is the king of, or last guy, very last talent of this typical kayfabe era, that he wouldn't let people know how much he understood. And I believe he really understood Japanese language a lot more than he lets out. So, and also, when he says he never learned, means that he didn't really learn the proper grammar of Japanese language. He picked it up. He listened to two Japanese people speaking to each other in Japanese language. He understood. Yeah.
I mean, if you're there for a long enough time in any country, you're going to be able to survive.
Yeah, you just sit there and actually you know what's going on, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because when I started to study Japanese more seriously, when I found out how people were talking to each other, it's not that complicated. I mean, it's quite a simple discourse.
Everyday language.
Yeah, no Japanese lessons for anyone. That's very boring. We want to talk about wrestling, don't we?
That's how international superstar made their living.
That's right. Know? Oh, and before we go, there's one thing we forgot to do. This is the write that down moment for everybody. I want Fumi-san, can you explain the spelling of Keiji Muto's name?
Oh, yeah. It was a topic in some Facebook site, you know, just the other night. Muto is how Muto himself spelled his own name. You know, mm-hmm. Just like my name, Saito, S-A-I-T-O. But sometimes it's in kanji and katakanas, Japanese writing, right? Characters. So you have to romanize it with alphabet. So some people go ahead and spell their name Muto, M-U-T-O-H. Or sometimes they go ahead and spell my name S-A-I-T-O-H, like a Saito, right? Muto, you know. But then also in some baseball circle that they do put H at the end of your last name alphabet because of the tribute to home run king, Mr. Baseball, Sarahara O, if you know who he is. Yeah. Sarahara O, his last name O-H, you know, like, oh my God's O. But some people do prefer spelling their name with H on the end. Saito, Sato, Ito, Kondo. Goto, for that matter, yes.
So sometimes it's a stylized choice by the person.
By a person, yeah. But the Muto himself, he spells it M-U-T-O, no H. And going to Muto office, you know, official website for his merchandising, none of his T-shirt or button or posters or clothing or anything, it's always KG Muto, M-U-T-O. Yeah.
And I don't understand.
That's how he himself, yeah.
If they think, if there's an H in it, wouldn't they put an H for Muta too? Great Muta? And that doesn't make sense.
And also, Great Muta was a mistake by WCW that Muto himself, you know, always spelled it M-U-T-O, right? They thought it was Muta. So then somebody started spelling like M-U-T-A instead.
Oh, I mean.
Yeah, that's how Great Muta was born.
Out of a kind of almost an accident.
Mistake, yeah. Spelling it. Just like, you know, if you remember, you know, Onita's rival, Mr. Pogo, he meant to be Togo, Mr. Togo, T-O-G-O. But the program in Texas, they printed as a Pogo, P instead. And then Mr. Pogo was born.
I heard the same story about Nozawa Rongai.
Yeah,
he was supposed to be Nozawa, or
Well, Z is fine, but in Mexico, Z don't pronounce it, so it became S instead of Nozawa.
So he kept it.
Yeah, but if you spell Nozawa, English speaking people will probably read it as a Misawa. I mean Nozawa. Mm-hmm. See, a lot of times, if you remember Misawa, it's pronounced Mizawa in America.
That's right. I hear different kinds of pronunciations, and there are, for quite a few wrestlers, I've heard all kinds of different pronunciations.
Yeah. So a lot of the Americans still say Mizawa, you know? It's interesting.
So write that down. That's the write that down moment of the day. since we finished.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm really excited to talk about Stan Hansen. Yes.
Stan Hansen is going to open up different avenues and glimpses into what we were.
Yeah, not just about Stan Hansen, but how American wrestlers in Japan, or how, you know, Japanese professional wrestling community, or how Japanese company run wrestling, or what America mean, American wrestlers and American superstar mean in Japan, and how he choose to have his franchise in Japan. See, he was initial group in 1984 to go to WWE National.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, Stan Hansen was among the group, you know. Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, the Paul Orndorff, the Jimmy Snuka, the Roddy Piper, the Cowboy Bob Orton, that the very first initial group going national tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stan Hansen was among that group, but he chose to sign longer contracts with All Japan. Actually, All Japan never had written contracts with Stan Hansen all these years, that it was handshake, believe it or not, handshake between Stan Hansen and Giant Baba. And it was like that for another 20 years. Can you believe that?
For 20 years. And then even after Baba had passed away, he came back and met with Muto and worked for Muto.
Yeah, yeah. But always had Mrs. Baba's blessing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
Stan Hansen always had his place in Japan. He still does.
Still does. And it's
still does.
There's a lot to, especially with Stan Hansen. He's a really important piece of the puzzle too. I mean, if anybody liked the Hulk Hogan episode we did, imagine all of that sort of thing, just a lot more and on even bigger scale at some points. I mean, and he affected a lot of different
We know a lot about wrestling business in general. Yes.
Yeah. And he affected a lot of different generations too, from the 70s, 80s and 90s. Not many wrestlers have that.
Yeah, Inoki's era of New Japan and Baba's era of New Japan, Jumbo's era of New Japan, he fought every single Japanese superstar all the way down to Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada, all the way, you know? And he was the same Stan Hansen. Amazing.
I'm excited to do this one.
Oh, good, good.
So.
Yeah, very good.
So that's it. So everyone, we'll see you next time with Stan Hansen. More info on Stan Hansen.
Hope we had a good episode today.
If you like the episode, let us know. Let us know on Patreon. Let us know on Twitter. Fumi, what's your Twitter handle so people can get a hold of you?
Twitter, Fumihiko Dayo, FumihikoDayo. Fumihiko Dayo. Or you could just find me, Fumi Saito, on Facebook.
And I'm at Justin M. Nipper, KNIPPR, on Twitter. And we'll be back next time with Stan Hansen, part 1. So
long from Tokyo.